Oh, you guys know what I'm talking about too. Like, was it Baby Gronk?
Oh yeah, Baby Gronk. Yeah,
you sounded like you sounded kind of like the Baby Gronk announcer. You know, he's like, and Baby Gronk was a Zulu, and then a Zulu did this, and he's white, and he did, and it was just like, I was like, wait, what?
Zulus, are the Zulus rising up for an Eskimo?
Shit, man. Oh, that's the intro right there.
Welcome back to the Trilateral Troika. This is Steve, along with the other Steve.
Happy New Year.
And Ryan.
I have recently had this coworker, very nice guy, very country. And his like country euphemisms that he uses all the time are just absolutely fucking killing me when he does them.
Man, you'll go the nine cow blowing five cow.
Not even though, because he's so good with it. He like the last one I heard is there was a patient
slicker who was, like, than greased owl shit.
Listen, patient was having a seizure, and then later on we were talking about it, he says, man, you're shaking worse than a dog shitting a bone.
Listen to me. Oh my god.
I laughed for like 15
fucking I might have to work that one in. What are you so scared about? You're shaking worse than a dog shitting a bone.
You got to learn how to separate fly shit from pepper, whatever the fuck that means. Like, I love this dude. He's great, but he also makes me feel very strange and self-conscious because I don't know what he's talking about half the time.
Well, that's fine. You know, that's how you get better. All right. Speaking of fly shit. Speaking of confusing fly shit and pepper flakes,
it is not too far off.
Oh god.
Because today, boys, we're going to start a discussion of Richard John Bingham, the 7th Earl of Lucan.
What?
Dick John Bingham?
Yeah, Dick John Bingham.
Alright, so
Big Dick John, as they called him.
Give me the elevator pitch of why I care about Big Dick Bingham.
Oh, we'll get to it. I feel it's kind of like that we ease into
this. Could he beat Molina Karanga in like a street race?
I mean, he would bet on the race.
Hang on a minute. So this is somebody who you can't even give me the elevator pitch because it's going to be better if it just hits me like a truck.
I just want to see how you react to things going. We'll get to the big, like, this will be a build up to the actual events that transpire that like makes him like an international celebrity.
Oh, Jesus Christ. Okay. All right.
So Richard John Bingham was born on December 18th, 1934 at 19th Bentinck Street, Marylebone, London, the second child and elder son of George Bingham, the 6th Earl of Lucan, an Anglo-Irish peer, and his wife, Caitlin Elizabeth Ann Dawson.
God, there's so many fucking names already.
Bentinck, like Bentinck Behemoth?
Bentinck, like Bentinck.
Oh, okay. Yeah. I rolled with a Bentinck Behemoth in my deck every once in a while, you know? What was that, like 7 for like a 7/6 blue with no abilities?
Yeah, it sounds about right.
It was something ridiculous. Let's see how good.
Something that was good back in the day.
No, dude, you know what? You
could easily cheat out better.
You know what though? It's an uncommon. Actually, I didn't know that. And it's actually 8 for a 7/6 with Island Walk. I didn't know that. That's crazy. Island Walk means if your opponent has any islands, Ryan, as their mana, then he's unblockable.
Is this in Magic?
Yeah, it's a Magic the Gathering. They've kind of done away with Landwalk.
So listen.
Shadow still comes up.
Since high school for somebody to teach me and be patient and teach me like I'm a 5-year-old Magic.
Dude, let me tell you something.
Never sat down.
I could teach you.
I'm so depressed.
I've been playing since 96, something like that. But Steve could teach you in like 5 minutes. Steve could teach you how to play in like 5 minutes, dude. Seriously, it's not a hard game at all.
All right, you need to remember who you're talking to, Buster.
I know, dude. You're a nurse. You can definitely play magic. Trust me. It's way easier than anyone really thinks. What makes it seem complicated is it's kind of like learning music. Like, I can teach you how to play a piano with your right hand, no problem, right? You could play basic melodies. It wouldn't take long, less than a month, right? But when you start building songs out of notes, then it's like, whoa, what is this? How does this get played? That's what happens when you build a deck. Mm-hmm. And so the decks themselves look complex because they're the collections of the basics. But the basics are really easy in Magic. You could learn the basics in an hour. Mm-hmm. And then just figuring out how to build a deck and like the interplay and how to like time things and things like that, that just takes time. That's all. So if you you'll know if you like it when you first learn how to play too. Like you just, know.
It took me until 2023 to play D&D for the very first time, and that annoyed me because I've wanted to play D&D since I was in high school.
Same. I've only played once to this day.
Yeah. The people that have tried to teach me magic in the past just seem to have like no patience, so I've never learned it, and it's killed me.
I don't get that, but I'm telling you, Stevie could teach you in like no time. I don't play as much anymore. Rare. Sorry. It was a rare. I didn't know it was a rare.
It might have gotten, check Scryfall, it might have gotten upbumped.
Yeah, it's possible. Yeah. Seventh edition. Man.
John was the great great grandson of George Bingham, the third Earl of Lucan, who led the charge of the Light Brigade.
Really?
And refresh my memory, what was the charge of the Light Brigade?
It was a poem.
It's like a poem, and they were a brigade that did like a suicide charge on the Russians that they probably didn't need to do, but it's remembered as being like this heroic thing where they all got killed.
Why the fuck did they do it if they didn't need to?
Well, you see, the food was so bad. No, I'm just kidding.
What kind of shit is that? Well, you did say he was British, so right? Yeah, he's a British.
They all had the turbo flux, which was like, you know, they were shitting 24 hours a day. So yeah. It was better to just die.
Their rickets had rickets.
Yeah. Yeah, they had rickety rickets.
His mother had a blood clot in her lung, which forced her to remain in a nursing home. So he was initially cared for by the family's nursemaid, Lucy Sellers. At 3 years old, he began attending a pre-prep school in Tite Street with his elder sister, Jane.
I'd say what a blood clot in the lungs is no fucking joke. And if she's having this back in, the 30s and the 40s, yeah, she's cooked.
In 1939, as the Second World War began, him and his sister were taken to safety in Wales. In 1940, joined by their younger siblings, Sally and Hugh, the Lucan children traveled to Toronto, Canada, moving shortly thereafter to Mount Kisco, New York, in the United States. They stayed for 5 years with a multimillionaireess, Marcia Brady Tucker. John was in...
Marcia. Oh, that's a joke, right? Really? Marcia Brady?
Yeah, Marcia Brady Tucker.
All
right.
John was enrolled at the Harvey School and spent summer holidays away from his siblings at a summer camp in the Adirondack Mountains.
I thought those were chairs.
Where do you think they're made?
I'm joking.
The Adirondacks.
They're up there in New York, aren't they?
Isn't it like in central New York?
I think, yeah. I think so. Not sure.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay.
I haven't been that far north.
Really? Wait, really?
Yep. First north I've been is, let me see how far north that is.
Yeah, I guess as soon as you leave Jersey, they kind of like push you back in like Danny DeVito on the fucking meme. Kind of like, nope, get the fuck back in there.
Yeah. I mean, it's exactly that. Yeah, the furthest north I've been is Tarrytown, which is just off the Hudson River on the,
That's not that far north of Philadelphia, isn't it?
What?
Tarrytown?
Tarrytown? Yeah, it's really far north.
You got to get up there to like New Hampshire and Vermont where like you can make your own maple syrup and shit like that, dude. Coolest shit ever.
Yeah, Tarrytown's probably like a, I don't know, four hour drive from Philly, maybe. It's like Miami.
Well, not with we've come to a grinding halt on geography.
Yeah, now we're just talking like a bunch of dads. Yeah, no, that's way further than that. Where are you getting
just,
your numbers?
Just turn to that SNL bit where the bank that they'll make any change you want. They're just going through all the combinations of change they'll give you for like.
I can give you 16 bill. Nickels and a dime. I mean, that's what I could give you. You know, if you want. All right, so back to Alfred Lord Tennyson.
Well, in the U.S., John and his siblings lived in grandeur and wanted for nothing. But on their return to England in February of 1945, they were faced with the stark realities of wartime Britain. Rationing was still in force. Their former home at Cheyne Walk had been bombed, and the family's house at 22 Eaton Square had its windows blown out. Despite their noble ancestry, the sixth Earl and his wife were agnostics and socialists who preferred a more austere existence than that offered by Tucker, an extremely wealthy Christian.
Just to be clear real quick.
And Blake and Blair and Brent
during like the Tucker, Blitz, right?
And yeah, Todd. Okay. Hi, Todd. I'm Tucker.
Hi, Tucker. I'm Todd.
For a time, John suffered nightmares and was taken to a psychotherapist. As an adult, he remained an agnostic, but ensured that his children attended Sunday school, preferring to give them a traditional childhood.
Look, you got to at least be afraid of God for at least the first 11 years of your life. Maybe
we all did it. We were maybe, all miserable when we did it. You got to do it, too.
You got to do it, too.
I did it. Your grandfather did it. Your great-grandfather did it. His great-grandfather before him did it. You're going to do it, too.
We're got no problem teaching you about Santa Claus, but for some reason, we throw away Christ as soon as Christmas shows up. I mean, they're both imaginary figures.
All right, Dad, let's get you back to the home.
I still got 2 hours. I don't need to go home yet.
At Eton College, John developed a taste for gambling.
Uh-oh.
He supplemented his pocket money with an income from bookmaking, placing his earnings into a secret bank account and regularly left the school grounds to attend horse races.
You know what's that?
Bookie?
Oh, Lord. What's his name? Robert. Lord Grantham.
Okay.
What, from the Downton Abbey?
Yeah. I didn't know if you'd both seen it or not. But.
Well, there's actually a guy he becomes friends with that they did a Behind the Bastards on named John Aspinall, or Lord Aspinall. It was really funny because he became an honorary Zulu, and he got like a Zulu warrior funeral after he
what
died.
The hell?
Because he gave so much money to like the Zulu like political party that the Zulu king was controlling. And that the Zulu king, like in the early 90s, like at a rally, made him an honorary Zulu. So it's just this video. There's this video from like the early 90s of like his son at the funeral and being like an English lord just sort of standing at attention while these guys in like full Zulu like costume are dancing, like doing a war dance around his father's grave, and the rest of the family is just like, what the fuck is going on?
That's fucking hilarious though.
For some reason that story, like the way you were telling it, it kind of sounded like what's that guy's name? That like that chubby kid that they're always putting up. What fuck's his name? Oh, you guys know what I'm talking about too. Like was it Baby Gronk?
Oh yeah, Baby Gronk.
Yeah. You sounded kinda like the Baby Gronk announcer, you know, he's like, and Baby Gronk was a Zulu, and then a Zulu did this, and he's white, and he did, and it was just like, I was like, wait, what?
Are the Zulus rising up, Lord Aspinall?
Shit, man. Oh, that's the intro right there. Fuck.
Fucking God.
And we cut 14 minutes of me trying to remember fucking Baby Gronk's name out. Oh, my God. Are the Zulus rising up? Tom Aspinall. fuck. Okay, next.
According to his mother, John's academic record was quote-unquote far from credible. But he became captain of Roadhouse before leaving in 1953 to undertake his national service.
Roadhouse. Oh, sorry, Roadhouse.
Yeah. Who was that? He did a semester in the woods fighting fucking rednecks.
Roadhouse.
My God, just been kicking people to death.
You say you're from England.
He became a second lieutenant in his father's regiment, the Coldstream Guards, and was stationed mainly in Krefeld, West Germany.
Yeah, that's where you normally get stationed there, Krefeld.
While there, he also became a very accomplished poker player.
Oh, okay, cool. How good? British,
enough that he almost becomes like a professional gambler in a sense.
Oh, wow. Okay, I have a stupid question.
What kind of poker?
I'm assuming regular. I don't think they're playing Texas Hold'em.
The fuck is regular? There's many different variations.
He's talking about five card draw. You know.
Yeah, just regular five card draw poker.
Okay. So I have a question.
I should say standard.
How can you be professional at poker when poker is entirely a game based on luck?
First of all, poker is a skill-based activity.
Here we go.
Okay.
Here we go.
There's no world in where poker is not a skill-based activity. Of course, there's RNG, but you don't even play the cards at high levels. You play
poker,
the players.
Poker is a skill-based game because I know people who are like very good at like counting cards and playing poker, and like to the point that like they don't like to gamble here in Florida because the Seminoles have a monopoly on the casinos, and that if you win too much, they essentially just ban you.
Yeah, but you like, can get good at poker and not be a count card, a card counter.
How though? It's literally just luck.
Well, it's not a lot of luck.
Social engineering luck. There's luck's involved, but there's a lot of social engineering, a lot of reading other people. Like
there's social engineering, but it's just literally
how does meeting other people help you get a card
because,
dealt in your hand?
Because you're only talking about one aspect of the game. I mean, it's not the most important aspect of the game, because the thing is if you're playing five schmucks in a hand. Well, I mean, you know, if you don't want me to make my argument, then I won't.
But we will. We'll talk about the other game he goes on to, which is pretty much an entirely luck based game that he sort of dedicates his life to.
Jesus,
okay. Like Pharaoh.
we'll get to that.
Slot machines.
A game they can never fix.
Slots, the untouchable game.
These are regulated by the state. See this here? That means that they have to pay out.
Well, that's the fix.
And Lord Lucan leaving 1-star reviews at casinos that he loses at, leaving 5-star reviews at the casinos he wins at.
Jeez.
On leaving the British Army in 1954, Lucan joined William Brandt's Sons & Co., a London-based merchant bank, on an annual salary of £500. In 1960, he met Stephen Raphael, a rich stockbroker who was a skilled backgammon player. They would holiday together in the Bahamas, went water skiing, played golf, backgammon, and poker.
Oh, Luke, would they? They holidayed together in the Bahamas, huh?
Well, you know, a boarding school education.
Yeah.
Lucan became a regular gambler and an early member of John Aspinall's Claremont Gaming Club, located in Berkeley Square. That was the guy I mentioned earlier, who's most known for being like essentially the epicenter of like gambling in the London area among like the elite in Britain, and also running like several illicit zoos.
But isn't that guy's in the UFC? Tom Aspinall. Pretty sure. Because you keep saying his name, and I'm like, I don't recognize him historically. Yeah, he's a fucking heavyweight. His name's Tom Aspinall. He has to have multiple eye surgeries. Oof.
Lucan often won at games of skill like backgammon and bridge, but he also accumulated huge losses.
How can you win in backgammon? I mean, all you do is roll the dice. I mean, if you can't get the die that you want, then there's 100% nothing else to the game, right? It's nothing else in the game, right?
I actually have no idea what the rules are to back
games. I am a bastard when it comes to this poker shit. Backgammon is like dice roll. It's literally like a racing game, and it's really hard to. I mean, it's skill based, but it's significantly influenced by dice rolls. So,
on one occasion, he lost 8,000 pounds, or about 2/3 of the money he received annually from various family trusts,
or about the number I gave his mom last night.
On one very bad night at the casino, he lost 10,000 pounds.
Goddamn.
What's that in today's pounds?
I don't know the exact date, but I'm assuming it's going to be like a ridiculous number.
Yeah, it's got to be like, what, 100,000? 100,000?
Yeah, it's got to be high. Steve's just on Wolfram Alpha. Just typing in the freaking equation. 18,000 pounds in 1846.
It's like.
Now, you know what's taking him so long? He's trying to avoid using AI, which is fucking impossible anymore.
Well, if you look at the inflation calculator, it says that the English pound has lost 96% of its value since 1964.
Oh my God.
So 100 pounds in 1964 is worth 2,589,000 pounds today.
Okay.
No, it's worth less, but it would be a higher number because of inflation.
Wait, 1964?
Yeah, 1964.
I thought this was like happening in like the 1800s for some reason.
No, this is
Lord Byron, whatever the fuck his name is. That's why.
This is even worse. It's 1954.
Oh, God.
Yeah, this is all like modern time. Like, he died within our lifetime.
Our parents were alive for this shit.
But 100 pounds in 1954 is worth 3,498 pounds and 97 pence, I guess. I don't know how it works because they did not have decimalization then. So you can't really give an accurate amount, but that's the value.
They didn't have a decimal point back then?
No, they did not have decimal. Decimalization wasn't added to the pound until like the 70s or 80s, I think.
So then what do they do? Like everything costs like a whole amount?
Well, you would have like, there were just different pences.
Oh, okay.
And stuff like there was like a million different little coins that you would have, which is why they just like abolished it and just went over to like a sane system.
Gotcha.
Yeah, 1971, they switched over to the decimal.
Interesting.
So he's already, by this point, he's losing massive amounts of money. His uncle by marriage, a stockbroker, John Bevan, helped him to pay that debt of 10,000 pounds. And Lucan repaid his uncle 2 years later.
And what's the best thing that you can do when you start to lose money? Is start to gamble. I'm not going to lie to you guys. The fucking DraftKings and Hard Rock Bets, dude, those apps are calling to me like the Green Goblin Mask, bro. I want you so bad, but
John,
I know better.
John Daly's yelling.
I use the Hard Rock app, man. It's I play grandmom bets. I put $20, $25 in. At the beginning of a season, I want to bet on, so like baseball or football, and I don't put any more money on the rest of the season. So it's not that I'm doing well, but I just don't bet a lot of money. Mm-hmm. But this year I won like, I mean, I don't care saying it on, I won like 200 something on like a $1 bet. So now I have this massive amount of money compared to what I would normally put in there, and I'm making grandmom bets with it. Mm-hmm. They send me like 50 fucking emails a day. It's ridiculous. Hey, you can make another bet. You know?
Yeah.
Did you That's know?
Too.
Did That's you know? Too. It's 3. It's 3:01 p.m.
Predatory.
And you're at work. Did you know that they're playing badminton in fucking Svalbard? Did you know that? Did you know we have odds on that?
They have agents whose entire job it is to make you bet more, and then when you've gotten to a point where you can't bet anymore and they can't pressure you to take out like personal loans to bet more, they just like cut you off.
Dude, they'll never cut anybody off this app. They make so much money.
Well, no, I mean, they cut you off. Like, Like, they're not going to email you anymore. Like, they're just going to leave you be.
And listen, there's a shitload of chance in sports betting, but it is a skill-based activity. Because people, if you have enough, we live in, like, the worst fucking era for betting. Because we have so much information now. So mm-hmm. there are tons of professional sports gamblers. They make a killing. Six figures.
But even professional sports bettors, they only succeed like 51% of the time generally.
Yeah, hey, but the, most of them, half, but most of them are doing pretty well because once they get all that money out, you know, and the problem is there's just too much variability at the end of the day. It's way too much. But at the end of the day, you want to see that ticket hit.
One good bet, baby.
Got to hit that good ticket.
One, baby.
You just got to put the $1. Just do what I did. Just put the $1 on a fucking parlay that makes no fucking sense, you know? Nothing at all.
Bet like your girlfriend, your wife, the woman in your life would bet. I like their team's colors, so I'm going to pick them to win. And if for some reason, yeah. that dumb shit works.
Well, they were almost bankrupted by the Castellanos voting.
Oh my god, that's funny.
There was a whole thing that you could bet, like a prop bet. You could bet like when a major event happened in the world that Castellanos would hit a line drive.
Yeah, they put odds up on it, and tons of people took it.
But it was one that you'd make so little, but so many people were betting on it that they were actually like losing a lot of money on the bets.
What's crazy is
they still had to pay them out.
What's crazy is that they have every single one of them. Doesn't matter who it is. There's rules in their like terms that say that they can just cancel or null out a bet at any point in time, and they don't have to give you a reason.
Yeah,
that's bullshit. I guess it's so that they have an out if they detect something like quote unquote suspicious.
Well, if they fuck up, there's already rules for that. Where like they don't know you anything. It's
much like Robin Hood, where
the thing is you won't win the money, but they'll give you back all your money. So like even you get your bet back. So that's how they consider it fair.
So you're gonna tell me if I hit like. A parlay that's going to pay out like $20,000.
I know.
Like, actually, no, we're not going to do that.
They can do it. I've never heard of them doing it, but I wouldn't be surprised. You know,
I would lose my mind.
Yeah, that's a rough thing. Not everyone should have access to it. And if you have a problem, because we have like 30 listeners now, call 1-800-GAMBLER. If you're in the U.S., if you're outside the U.S., I got shit for you, you know.
We have to...
You just go to Macau and get drunk, you know.
If you're outside the U.S., just stop gambling. It's don't be gambling.
If you're outside the U.S., yeah, if you're outside the U.S. and you're in a room with more than four Asian people and it's smoky, just get the fuck out of there. Go outside.
Yeah, that's just a bad place to be.
Very bad place. Yeah, you're about to lose everything.
We have to play the 5-minute ad that they always play on the UK podcast they listen to where they advertise for Betfair.
That's awesome.
Lucan left France around 1960, shortly after he had won 26,000 pounds playing Chemin de Fer, which is a variant of Baccarat.
That's the problem. You need a chronic gambler to win big like that. Then you set the you know standard that hey, listen, man, it's possible to win like this. Just keep betting,
dude.
A colleague had been promoted before him, leading him to leave his job in protest, saying, "Why should I work in a bank when I can earn a year's money in one single night at the tables?"
See what I'm saying?
Lucan then traveled to the U.S. where he played golf, raced powerboats, and drove his Aston Martin around the West Coast. He also visited his sister Jane and his former guardian, Marcia Tucker. On his return to England, he moved out of his parents' home in St. John's Wood and into a flat in Park Crescent. Lucan met his future wife, Veronica Duncan, early in 1963. She was born in 1937 to Major Charles Morehouse Duncan and his wife, Thelma. Veronica's father had died in a car accident when she was young, after which the family moved to South Africa. Her mother remarried, and her family returned to England, where her new stepfather became manager of a hotel in Guildford. With her sister, Christina, she was educated at St. Swithin's School in Winchester.
That sounds like the most preparatory, bougie, stuffy, highfalutin prep school I've ever heard of in my life.
After displaying a talent for art, Veronica went on to study at an art college in Bournemouth. The two sisters later shared a flat in London where Veronica worked as a model and later as a secretary. Christina's marriage to a wealthy William Shand kid, half-brother to Peter Shand kid, stepfather of Diana Spencer, who would later become the Princess of Wales, introduced her to London high society, and it was at a golf club function in the country that Veronica and Lucan first met. News of their engagement appeared in the Times and the Daily Telegraph newspapers on October 14th, 1963, and the two were married at Holy Trinity Church, Brompton, on November 20th. After a ceremony attended by Princess Alice, Countess Athlone, one of whose ladies-in-waiting had been a relative of Lady Lucan, but a few other prominent members of high society, the couple honeymooned in Europe, traveling first class on the Orient Express.
The Orient Express of the same thing? The
Poirot murder book, yeah.
Interesting.
Lucan's already embattled finances were given a welcome boost by his father, who provided him with a marriage settlement designed to finance a larger family home and any future additions to the Lucan family. Lucan repaid some of his creditors and purchased 46 Lower Belgrave Street in Belgravia, redecorating it to suit Veronica's taste.
His dad got all excited at that point. He's like, oh my God, he's not going to gamble with it. Oh my God. I think we've turned the corner, Mom.
Fucking finally.
He's just going over, like, trying to get to this house before, like, right after the newspaper's delivered so we can get the horse horse betting section out of the paper.
Finally, yeah. I can read the sports section again. Motherfucker's been stealing it from me for years.
They convinced me that the local newspaper didn't have a sports section.
2 months after the wedding on January 21st, 1964, Lucan's father died of a stroke.
Oof.
In addition to a reputed £250,000 inheritance, Lucan acquired his father's titles, Earl of Lucan, Baron Lucan of Castlebar, Baron Bingham of Malcolm Bingham, and Baronet Bingham of Castlebar. His wife became the Countess of Lucan.
Wow. This guy's got 37 names. His wife is the Countess.
Does she, like, have to upgrade her wardrobe and shit now, or?
I mean, she was already in high society. She's palling around with the Spencers, who are rich enough that, you know, that their daughter can marry the king.
She's got to get the
crown prince. The couple had three children. Lady Frances Bingham, born on October 24th, 1964. George Bingham, 8th Earl of Lucan, born on September 21st, 1967, and Lady Camilla Bingham, born on June 30th, 1970.
June 30th.
Following the 1964 birth of their first daughter, Frances, from early in 1965, they employed a nanny, Lillian Jenkins, to look after her. Lucan tried to teach Veronica about gambling and traditional pursuits like hunting, shooting, and fishing.
Am I the only one who bought her
hunting?
When you hear, go ahead.
Traditional pursuits: hunting, fishing, gambling.
These are manly pursuits.
He bought her golf lessons, but she would later give up the sport.
I'm also going to teach you how to shave your beard. I'm going to show you how to skin a squirrel. Oh,
this is his wife, by the way.
Yeah. This is also 1965. You don't need to skin a squirrel in 1965.
Why are you being sexist, bro? She can know this stuff.
Maybe you don't want people to think your wife is a good time girl.
Maybe she was.
You know? Maybe she was.
Lucan's daily routine consists of breakfast at 9 a.m., coffee, dealing with the morning's letters, reading the newspapers, and playing the piano.
That sounds just like my morning.
He sometimes jogged to the park and took his Doberman for walks. Lunch at the Claremont Club was followed by afternoon games at backgammon.
Nah, fuck Claremont.
Returning home in the evening to change into black tie, the Earl typically spent the remainder of the day at the Claremont, gambling into the early hours, watching some watched sometimes by Veronica. In 1965,
I don't know why these guys didn't just create, like, they had enough money, they could just make a fake casino where they use, you know, Lord Bucks and just, you know, lose and win and play pretend, you know.
Yeah,
but that's just that Twilight Zone episode, you know.
Yep, that's a good one.
It's insane to me. This dude's life is just wake up late, fuck around for a few hours, go take a shower, go take a nap, go gamble, come back, go to sleep again. It's like, dude, fuck you.
That's why they end up being like murderers or fucking wackadoos in some way.
You know, he just spends the first half of his day gooning and the second half of his day gambling.
Looks maxing.
Gooning. I'll be out in the yard, Marge.
Doing that jaw clench or whatever to the Sigma.
I gotta get my fucking alpha male jaw going. I start chewing gum, and by the end of the day, I'm chewing 3 packs of Juicy Fruit at one time.
Like the fucking defensive coordinator of the fucking Pittsburgh Steelers.
This is one day there will be a man. A man of South Asian extraction named Kumail Nanjiani, and one day the freakish
his jaw was foretold.
The freakish steroid jaw of that man.
Was he roided up?
Oh, I'm sorry. Special teams coordinator. Oh. Sorry, it's Danny Smith, special teams coordinator. You guys know about that, right? Like, he chews, he's infamous, like, on the sidelines. The special teams guy.
I don't know who he was, but I know
he puts, like,
about.
A fucking entire, like, thing of big league chew in his mouth. Like, he's pulling, like, the grade school, like, schoolyard, like, dare. I bet you won't chew like that whole package, you know? Fuck, I won't, dickhead. Put the whole thing in, you have to get your jaw fucking wired open. Wired open.
In 1965, while still working at Brandt's, he had written of his desire to have £2 million in the bank, claiming that motor cars, yachts, expensive holidays, and security for the future would give myself a lot of other people a lot of pleasure.
Did you say working? He wasn't working.
This was while he was still working at Brandt's in 1965.
Oh, okay.
So he wrote this down and kind of like, oh, so this is why. He's like going at this. He's trying to get his 2 million. He's got that that fire, whatever, that early
trying to get 2 million.
You gotta stay hungry, you know.
Always be grinding.
Lucan was described by his friends as a shy and taciturn man, but with his tall stature, luxuriant guardsman's mustache, and masculine pursuits. His exploits made him popular. He would.
They're saying he was like a quiet douchebag, but because he was big and like, I guess, fairly decent looking, like a man's man. Yeah.
He's rich, is what it is. Yeah. He's rich.
It's money, right? Like, that's what I was getting at. Like, it's not that. It's because he's rich. Money.
He would, his extravagance would include hiring private aircraft to take his friends to the races, asking a car dealer he knew to source an Aston Martin drophead coupe, drinking expensive Russian vodka, and racing powerboats.
Powerboats, wow.
In September of 1966, he unsuccessfully screen tested for a part in Woman Times 7, prompting him to decline a later offer from film producer Albert R. Broccoli to screen test him for the role of James Bond.
You say Albert R. Broccoli?
Yes.
What a name. I love it. Also, I need to look this guy up. I need to get a picture of this guy who thinks that he is going to be fucking James Bond. Hang on. Big Dick Bond.
Big Dickum. Dick John Dickum.
As a professional gambler, Lucan was a skilled player, once rated amongst the world's top 10 backgammon competitors.
This guy's amazing.
He looks like Gomez from Adam's Family, dog.
Look at the tier that Gomez was freaking playing in, though.
I mean,
you can't be talking shit, Daddy.
But I mean, that's what I'm saying. Like, he looks
Gomez is an example for us all. I mean,
he looks like a taller, whiter Gomez. That's what this guy
Gomez
looks like.
Gomez is a short king.
Yeah, he's definitely short.
especially comic Gomez.
It's the definition of a short king at that point.
He won the St. James Club Tournament and was champion of the West Coast of America. He gained the moniker Lucky Lucan, but his losses easily outweighed his winnings. In reality, he was not really that lucky.
Okay.
He had interest in thoroughbred horses, and in 1968, he paid more in race entry fees than he received in winnings.
Damn, bro, that sucks.
Despite some arguments over money, Veronica remained largely ignorant of his losses, retaining the use of accounts at several row tailors and various Knightsbridge shops.
Okay.
Following the births of George and Camilla, Veronica suffered postnatal depression. Lucan became increasingly involved in her mental well-being, and in 1971 took her for treatment at a psychiatric clinic in Hampstead, where she refused to be admitted.
So here's the thing. He's at least doing objectively the right things, it seems like, even if he's a gambling degenerate.
I mean, we'll get to that.
Oh, God.
It said she agreed to home visits from a psychiatrist and a course of antidepressants. And in July of 1972, the family holidayed at Monte Carlo, but Veronica quickly returned to England, leaving Lucan with their two elder children. The combined pressures of maintaining their finances, the cost of his gambling addiction, and Veronica's weakened mental condition took their toll on the marriage. 2 weeks after a strained family Christmas in 1972, Lucan moved into a small property in Eaton Row.
So what happened? Do we know what happened? Like,
I think, you know, just fighting over the holidays.
Fighting over the holidays. Oof, tough time. Tough time.
Lady Lucan later described this as the point of their formal separation in January of 1973. Some months later, Lucan moved again to a larger rented flat in nearby Elizabeth Street. Despite an early attempt by his wife at reconciliation, by that point, all Lucan wanted from the marriage was custody of his children. In an effort to demonstrate that Veronica was unfit to look after them, Lucan began to spy on his family. His car was regularly seen parked in Lower Belgrave Street, later employing private detectives to perform the same task. He also canvassed doctors who explained that his wife had not, quote-unquote, gone mad, but was suffering from depression and anxiety. So, like, while his wife is suffering from, like, obviously suffering from anxiety and depression, like they're saying, like, he wants to commit her for that.
Yeah.
Which, this is also this a 1970s this is asylum.
Yeah. And also, this is the 70s. This isn't like the fucking 1800s. We know what anxiety and depression are in the 70s.
Hmm. You know, if this was 1870, they would just be like right away. So.
Well, in the 1870s, they would first be like, here, use this vibrator on her and see if that works. Otherwise, yeah, we're going to go and
come the in. The second she comes to the door, a large muscular man like hits her with a butterfly net, and another man comes, like a smaller, skinnier man comes from the side, hits her in the head with a hammer.
Fucking, they have like a sham trial. Isn't it we true that you're crazy? I'm not crazy.
She won't bother you anymore.
Crazy though, no? To me.
Ah, oh, that's something a crazy person would say.
So let me get this straight. Your wife doesn't like the fact that you're gambling too much.
Bugger that.
God.
Lucan told his friends that nobody would work for Veronica. She had sacked Jenkins, the family's long-term nanny, in December of 1972.
Son of a bitch.
Of the series of natives employed in the house, 126-year-old Stefania Salvica was told by Veronica that Lucan had hit her with a cane and had on one occasion pushed her down the stairs.
Is that true, or
that Lucan had done that to her? Probably. Yeah.
Okay. Oh, he's a wife beater too. Okay.
The Countess apparently feared for her safety and told Safika not to be surprised if he kills me one day.
All right, what comedian talking like, about Kirk. I'm not suicidal.
Something here. Is this guy going to kill his family?
He doesn't kill his family. But so
probably
we get
slowly with time, the mental death of gambling addiction.
Time at the Lucan household ended in March of 1973. While with two of the children near Grosvenor Place, she was confronted by Lucan and two private detectives. They told her that the children had been made wards of the court and that she must release them into his custody, which she did. Francis was collected from school later in the day. Veronica applied to the court to have the children returned, but concerned about the case's complexity, the judge set a date for the hearing 3 months ahead for June of 1973.
So the court took her kids just because Big Dick John went to him and said, hey, she's crazy, she has anxiety and depression, take the kids from her? Like that? Pretty much it?
Pretty much.
Yeah,
fuck. You see, he's a man and she's a woman, so...
Yeah.
So clearly my opinion weighs more than this silly woman.
Yeah.
Insane.
Her opinion is dickless. See?
I see what you did.
To defend herself against Lucan's claims about her mental state, Veronica booked herself a 4-day stay at the Priory Clinic in Roehampton. While it was acknowledged that she still required some psychiatric support, the doctors reported that there was no indication that she was mentally ill. Lucan's case depended on her being unable to care for the children, but at the hearing, he was instead forced to defend his own behavior toward her.
Yeah, you fucking putz.
Who's she, hire Cochran?
You got so much money, bro. Just give her whatever the fuck she wants, you dumbass.
Mr. Luke.
Who told you to use Lexapro?
Isn't it true that you gamble? I love that fucking guy. Jackie Childs from... The Simpsons, Seinfeld, sorry.
After several weeks of witnesses and protracted arguments in on camera, on the advice of his lawyers, he conceded the case. So this is notable enough that like the media is taking attention of it, and he's like having to answer for the fact that he's a degenerate gambler in court, and that the media is recording it. So he backs off.
Oh, what a fucking asshole!
Unimpressed by Lucan's character,
that's like the Trump Justice method.
You know? Justice Reese awarded custody to Veronica. The Earl was allowed access every other weekend.
You know, like when he sues somebody and then ultimately he backs off at the last minute because he's no way wants to go through discovery.
Big divorce dad energy. You get the kids every other weekend. Oh my fucking God. Supervised visitation or not?
Yeah.
Does he just get him no supervision? Do we know the court order on this? Does he wear his look it up. Balances?
starts getting really into looking into like sovereign citizen type stuff.
buys a workout bench for the garage.
Oh my gosh.
So your mom's new boyfriend Jeff, you know, he does that, but this, but but does Jeff let you stay up and watch rated R movies?
I don't think so.
This would begin a bitter dispute between the couple involving many of their friends and Veronica's own sister. Lucan again began to watch his wife's movements. He recorded some of their telephone conversations with a small Sony tape recorder and played excerpts to any friends prepared to listen. He also told them and his bank manager that Veronica had been, quote unquote, spending money like water. Lucan continued to pay her £40 a week and may have canceled their regular food order with Harrods.
Yeah, she was gambling. That's what I heard.
Yeah, I heard that she was getting really big into backgammon and she was losing.
That's why she keeps losing.
You know, not like me, I win at backgammon.
Yeah, she's a woman. She doesn't have the brain, you know, capacity to deal with backgammon. It's complicated.
She doesn't have the luck to win at backgammon.
Yeah. Yeah, there's no way. It's not like backgammon's a gain of skill. I mean, you know, but she's just a dumb broad. She doesn't know that.
She doesn't know fucking no shit.
She barely knows herself, you know?
Should have played the slots.
Yeah.
She doesn't even know what a parlay is.
Yeah. Yep.
Oh, fuck.
He would delay payment to the milkman, and knowing that Veronica was required by the cartoon.
What? I'm sorry. That was just me. Southern accent. Parlay.
It was required by the court to employ a live-in nanny through the child care agency. With no income of her own, Veronica took a part-time job at a local hospital. I'm not sure what the laws are at this time in terms of like women owning a bank account, but I think it was until 1971 in the United States that legally a woman could not have a bank account.
She should come prepared, bro.
Insane.
She could have a bank account, but she would need approval from
But it differed from state to state. Male
figure.
It
differed from state to state because my mom was a banker at the time, like low level banker.
But I think 1971 in the United States is when they put in the law that essentially said like, no, you can't deny a woman like a bank account because like,
yeah, it's crazy.
She doesn't have an uncle to sign for it. Or
it's literally just a little bit before we were born, you know.
A temporary nanny, Elizabeth Murphy, was befriended by Lucan, who bought her drinks and asked her for information on his wife. He instructed his detective agency to investigate Murphy, looking for evidence that she was failing in her duty to care for his children.
Jesus Christ, what is wrong with this guy?
This they found, but he dispensed with the detective agency services when they presented him with bills amounting to several hundred pounds.
Oh, so he's pulling the old Trump move. Bills are due. Nah, get the fuck out of here. I don't know you.
Murphy was later hospitalized with cancer.
Oh,
you got to keep that nut, man. You know, or else you can't gamble. So,
another temporary nanny, Cristobal Martin, reported strange telephone calls to the house. Some with heavy breathing, and some from a man asking for non-existent people.
Bart Simpson, like prank calls.
Yeah, it was looking for Hugh Jazz or Amanda. Yeah. Amanda Hug and Kiss.
Can I speak to IP Freeling? Is there an IP Freeling here?
And then when she realizes what that actually says, she just screams and throws the phone and runs away.
Or passes out.
Oh my! So it's the 1970s, though, so it's where that like gruffer Britain, where she's just like smoking a cigarette. It's like fuck off.
Quite the joker he is. 70s,
so it's back in the day when like prank calling was like a thing.
Yeah.
You know, he just gets the principal Skinner where he gets like thanked. He's like, oh yes, there was some food in there that was about to spoil. Thank you for letting me know.
Jeez. Just looks so confused.
Following a series of temporary nannies, Sandra Rivett started working for him in late 1974.
Xander.
Sandra Rivett will become important to the larger story.
What the fuck are you saying? Sandra Rivett? Sandra Rivett? What are you saying?
Sandra Rivett.
Sandra?
Yeah, Sandra.
Okay. Okay.
S-A-N-D-R-A and then R-I-V-E-T-T.
Okay.
Sandra.
Well, no, just because he was saying it like it was one whole word. Sandra Rivett. And I'm like, what is that, a Pokemon? What the fuck's going on?
It's a ground type.
Yeah, it's from Black and White 2.
This bitch is going to take me out, my whole crew.
But we will stop there, and we will continue on with the developing that come with this, and the ongoing saga of one Lord Lucan and his marital issues.
Oh my gosh! All right, well, I feel like it's going to get a lot worse, but yeah.
And in part two, Steve's going to explain to me why poker is a game of skill.
Nah, dude, you're fucked. You're going to have to look that shit up yourself. I offered to explain, and you kept interrupting me. Like,
all right, explain it to me right now. Right this second.
Nah, I'm good.
You have my attention. You have my undivided attention.
I got to go. I got stuff to get together for work tomorrow.
I know you're a poker player, right? And I know that me saying that it is nothing more than a game of luck when you fancy yourself as a skilled poker player is probably a kick to the nads. So that's what I'm telling
you. You're being way too laudatory. I am not a skilled poker player. Yeah. I've played poker, but like not that level. I have friends who did
Steve's
it.
Steve's big glasses.
One of my good friends was like, when poker was like at its like apex there in the mid 2000s, he was he had a radio show in Central Florida.
Oh, word?
Yeah. And, you know, it totally changed the way I looked at poker. And it's such a psychological game. It's like, you know, if you're just talking, all I was trying to say before was, if you sit down in a room and play five-card stud with someone, it's random. I mean, you can card count, and you could probably like understand all the statistics and memorize them. And then you could learn about the Ars Notoria and like how people can memorize massive lists of numbers, and not necessarily intelligent people. Like anyone can learn how to do it. Mm-hmm. And then it can spiral out of control from there. But once you add betting in, it's a whole completely different game. It's not the same game anymore. Because now it's nuance and reading people and then knowing the numbers and knowing the percentages. And it just like, it's a crazy amount of like skill that you have to learn how to do in multiple different fields. It's not just the cards. If it was just the cards, no one would play.
Okay.
Because it would just be for fun. Men, like grown men, wouldn't play it because it would just be basically like checkers.
But I mean, checkers has some strategy to it.
Checkers is a perfected game, which means that if both players play the exact right move, it ends in a draw.
Really?
Yeah, they proved it a couple years ago. Well, it was more like a decade ago. Really? But like the odds of you and I doing that are probably pretty low, especially for me. I'm terrible at checkers.
Right.
I'm okay at chess, but I hate checkers. But yeah, it's a perfected game. So, you know, it's one of those games where it's not that it's not worth playing. It's just like it's one of those ones that's been figured out. But no, I mean, again, I'm not saying that it's not a game of chance. Of course it's a game of chance, but playing it is a game of skill, especially at a higher level. And probably in like the short term. So like if you play one time, obviously you might get really unlucky, you know. But over the long term, if you don't develop skills in like reading people and knowing what the cards are, what the hands are, what the chances are, with the number of players that are in the game, mm-hmm. for you to get a good draw, and then if it's Texas Hold'em, like okay, the flop happened. There's a betting sequence. The fucking river had to turn, and it's just like there's a betting sequence. How many people are in the game? How much money do they have? What are they trying to do right now? Do they want to get me out of the game? It's like crazy mental skill, crazy at the high levels. They're not just like some weird douchebags who dress like fucking bowling alley divorced dads, you know. That's most of them are actually, but yeah. All of them. There's the fucking Asian dude in the tracksuit and like some guy wearing sunglasses and a cowboy hat indoors in the middle of summer. You know,
sweating profusely.
Just sweating so much sweat. An old cowboy, my favorite player, Doyle Brunson, just sitting there fucking rolling on people. I once played a $1 million game with Burl Ives. You know, like shit like that. These guys did not play just because it was like, you're still gambling, obviously, because there's always like level of chance in play, but there's chance in anything. Anyway, I could soapbox about it all day, but definitely a game of skill.
Well, on that note, boys, we will continue the saga of Ward Lucan and what the future entails for him. Bum, bum, bum.
Oh, late. God.
Wait a minute.
Good night. Good luck.
Bye.